And we're back on Vancouver Cooperative Radio. This is CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver. And you're listening to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. I'm your host, Robin Puga. And tonight, we're very happy to have on the show with us, Marty Frost. He's a co-op developer with DevCo. He's also a board member of the CCEC Credit Union in East Van. He's a board member of the Aunt Leah Foundation, and also a co-board member with me on the British Columbia Cooperative Associations Board. Marty also works with DevCo, which is a co-op of co-op developers. He works with Nick Orton and Melanie Kahn, and they provide technical assistance to groups who wish to form a cooperative here in BC. They're a very renowned co-op development co-op, and actually received the Distinguished Cooperator Award from the BC Cooperative Association, and Marty as well has received the Worker Co-op Merit Award for contributions to worker cooperation here in Canada. So thanks very much for joining us here on the show today, Marty.
It's a pleasure, Robin.
I'm really happy to get you in here to hopefully shed some light into this interesting, very important role of the co-op developer in the co-op sector. So I was hoping maybe you could just start with the most basic question. What does a co-op developer do?
Well, you kind of summed it up when you said we provide technical assistance to people that want to start co-ops. The idea of doing that, you know, on a sort of a contract basis, it's not new. It's fairly new in English-speaking Canada and certainly new in the West. But if you go to Quebec, there's a very well-developed network of cooperative developers. People there, cooperative development work there. Co-ops are a much larger part of their economic culture.
And the co-op developer, obviously, it sounds like they play an important role in developing co-ops in Quebec. Do they play the same important role here in BC?
Yes, they do. I mean, there's sort of evidence out there, statistical evidence that people who do use the services of a co-op developer when they're trying to start their co-ops, more of them get started. They actually do launch, and when they do launch, more of them survive. They survive longer. So I think that injection of information and support during those very critical development times, I think it definitely has a strengthening effect. Yeah.
Okay. And what would you attribute that statistical evidence to? Like, what part of the process to co-op developers aid?
Well, education, you know, when we're working with a co-op that's starting up, we always train the directors of the co-op before they sort of take on the role or soon after they take on the role. Depends on the scale, because, you know, the extent to which you work with co-ops really varies widely. You know, it could be as simple as, you know, providing a couple of hours of consultation to them when they're kind of on their way. It could be that you help them through the incorporation process and launch their first board of directors with them, or you can go the whole trip and, you know, do a feasibility study for their business idea, and then when they sort of get it together, help them with their business planning and help them with the launch or do launch support. That was a specialty when Nick was when he was here. Nick is in Santula now. Hello, Santula. When Nick was down here and we were working more closely together, some of the work that he did was actually post-launch. So you know, one of us would do the development side of things, and then Nick would take it on post-launch and get them started, right? So it's a whole thing, you know. Like, so many businesses fail in their early days. So many co-op groups, so many groups decide they want to form a co-op and then just get stalled in the paperwork and then the requirements for incorporation and all the rest of the requirements for financing and so on. They just get stalled, and often having somebody there that has kind of been through this for a few times and can tell them, oh no, you know, it's okay, you know, we can get through this, and often they do. When we did a bit of analysis for the BC Co-op Association a few years ago, Melanie and I did that as a DevCo contract, and you know, we found that the number of groups that came to us as developers or other people as developers, it really increased the likelihood that they would go through the process and actually get incorporated and launched. Lots of groups come in, they make some initial inquiries, and then they just disappear and you never hear from them again. But the ones where they actually had a chance to talk to Melanie or myself or other co-op developers, they tended to go through the process and actually get the co-op incorporated and launched.
Neat. So what's the state people come to you typically when I'm imagining, I mean, you're a co-op developer, people are coming to you, they've already kind of got co-op in their mind. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories is the person who says, I want to form a co-op.
You know? Yeah, right.
And here's my idea, you know, and it's got, my sort of stock response is, well, you go out and find the other people that are interested in doing this with you, and then come and we'll talk, you know. But I think that's one of the things. People often see co-op as just another form of starting a business, of organizing a business. And there's a quick learning curve there that they kind of we help them through, but generally the most common ones, the ones that work well, are ones that they have a group of minimum of three people, but you know, five people, six people, and they all do have a common vision of this co-op that they want to set up, and there's a certain amount of work you still kind of have to go through. One of the very early stage things I do with a group when I'm going to help them get set up is push that a little bit and just see how common the vision is. You know, they might all say that, you know, yes, we want to start a food store, but they might have quite different ideas about what that looks like. They might have different ideas about what their role is going to be in it, you know, that kind of thing. So generally that's one of the things that some of the opening conversations will be focused around, determining just how cohesive the vision is among the group.
And so what are the steps? You sounds like you really are kind of feeling out the group at the beginning, imagining you build a business plan of some sort.
Well, yeah, and the extent to which the co-op developer works with them often depends on what kind of resources they have available, you know, because as much as we'd love to, we can't work for free. And so generally the steps are, like I say, there's group work to be done right up front, and that's really going to help you determine kind of how much work this group is going to have. We have, in DevCo, we have this thing that we call the questions list. Basically what it is we've laid out a bunch of things that people have to ask themselves, and we ask people to try, you know, like get the group together and go through it and try and build consensus around these issues. Chances are that, you know, somebody goes away and just fills it out themselves and sends it to you. But the process of them actually working on these questions, because it's things like, what is the relationship going to be between the member and the co-op? Like, what is the co-op going to expect of you as a member, and what are you as a member going to expect of the co-op? And that really feeds into the process of crafting the co-op, because it tells you a lot about the member relationship and who the members of the co-op should be, how you should structure the membership. You know, you talk to them about, where's the money going to come from? You know, have you looked at the market for this product that you want to manufacture? All kinds of stuff like that. So you get through those questions, and eventually, if it kind of comes through, you know, we'll work to, again, kind of like I say, depending on the resources they have, we'll either start working, moving them toward incorporating the co-op, tell them that they really need to have some kind of feasibility study for the business, because they don't really know that it's going to work, except they're all totally convinced that it is. So feasibility study is good, and that, you know, and that's a good step toward your business plan, because really, if you've done a good feasibility study, that's like 60% of the work of the business plan done. So then, you know, you get that set up, and you talk to them about membership and how they develop their membership. You talk to them about their plans for the business, the business plan is really important. You know, the ones that have access to resources will often hire the developer to do the business plan as well. That's really good because you get to do more sort of development of the people, the members, at the same time. So, yeah.
Okay. And when you say development, development of the members and other people, what does that process look like?
That's talking to people about what it is to be a member of a co-op, helping the co-op craft its membership agreement, which lays out the obligations and the rights and responsibilities of membership, the obligations of the co-op, what is it you expect from the co-op, and what do you expect to have to provide the co-op. And member development then is kind of, again, you kind of have to look at the group and see what's needed, because often a lot of what's needed is working as a group. You know, some quite often you'll get a group, they're not used to working as a group. And so you have to kind of work with them, often indirectly, because, you know, you have to kind of gauge how ready to hear they are to hear that they're not working very well as a group. so you kind of work indirectly and develop their group skills and how they make decisions, you know, how they structure the board, and is that really the best way to do it? You know, there's all kinds of stuff like that goes on. But that's all part of the group development.
And so at what point do you start drafting the actual incorporation documents, that those rules and the memorandum of association and all that stuff? How far down the line is that?
Usually fairly early. I mean, again, that varies, because lots of people say, well, why would we do all of that if we don't have a viable business idea, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there is that, and you do have to, generally, when I'm working with a group, I'll kind of get a sense of how solid their business idea is, and I'll put those questions to them, you know? And again, like hearing how a group responds to hard questions, if you will, about the business, hearing how the group responds to it is really educational for a co-op developer, because again, you're getting that sense of the group and how much thought they've put into this and so on. But there's a theory that says you don't incorporate the co-op until you've done the business plan, right? There's another theory that says, how are you going to pay for the business plan if you don't have a way of applying for a grant or something, you know? and individuals often will not get a grant for starting a co-op, you know? So the approach is, you either set up the co-op and you use the co-op as a way of raising money. I mean, it instantly has some capital because it has some shares in the co-op, and that can help the co-op develop its next steps. So I'm an advocate for, in most cases, I'm an advocate for incorporating early. Get all those decisions out of the way. Get to, you know, have the group make a bunch of decisions about how the co-op's going to be structured and stuff. It gets them used to working together as a group. There will be directors when it's done, so they know now what their responsibilities or directors are, and I think they're in a much better position to proceed with the rest of the co-op, the development of the business side of the co-op.
So what does that process look like, the actual incorporation of that co-op, when they're ready to... when you've got the group together and figured out enough that you're like, this is the group, we should get together and form a co-op? What are those business steps that need to happen?
Business steps generally is you have to identify what the product is going to be, and you have to identify who your market is going to be, and then you have to start really putting the test to both your product and the market.
Like,
is it realistic? Can we do this? Can we make this product? Can we produce it, or service, whatever it is? And then, is there a market for it, of course? And if there is a market, can we really get enough revenue flow from what we're doing to do what we want to do, to support us if it's a worker co-op, you know, or are we going to save enough on our food if it's a food buying co-op, you know? So you have to kind of analyze it according to what their expectations are. But really, that's the step is getting a really good handle on, is there really a business here, and is it going to do for them what they expect it to do? You know, because again, you often people have unrealistic expectations of what they need, or unrealistic expectations of what they're going to get. You know, so again, you have to kind of look at it and be pretty blunt with people about how you're not going to get rich with this, right? You understand that, right? Like, this is not, you know, where you make some bottled water and then you sell out to Pepsi and retire. This is not what we're talking about here, right? And, you know, and so a lot of that stuff has to get out of the way. you have to get that out of the way and just get some very realistic expectations of what this co-op's really going to do for you.
So you touched on a couple of models real quick there, worker co-op and I think a consumer co-op model. But there's a wide variety of co-ops, and I was wondering if you could sort of touch on some of the ones that you typically find groups are kind of drawn towards and why you would choose one model over another.
Yeah. Definitely, you know, there are some kind of dominant models, right? I kind of categorize them. There are really only three types of co-ops. There are worker co-ops, producer co-ops, and consumer co-ops. And the rest of it is in the details. People would say, well, what about housing co-ops? I mean, really? You know, there are housing co-ops too, right? But a housing co-op really is a consumer co-op. Like, the members are getting a service from the co-op. They're getting a service in housing. Same as a food co-op. You're getting your food from the co-op. That's it. So you're the consumer. You're the consumer of what the co-op provides. You know, if you're looking at the co-op marketing a product that you're manufacturing, then it's a producer co-op. And again, all kinds of iterations of that. So if you from a legal context in BC, there are only two specific types of co-ops laid out in the Act, and that's a housing co-op and a community service co-op, which is the nonprofit form of co-op. Outside of that, a co-op is a co-op is a co-op. You know, and really, in legal terms, you set it up that way, and the nature, what type of co-op it is, really depends on what the member relationship is. So, if the co-op is there to provide work, it's a worker co-op. If it's an employment relationship, you know, if you're going to be buying services or goods from the co-op, it's a consumer co-op. If you're going to be selling goods and services to the co-op, it's a producer co-op. So that's why I keep coming back to it. Really, there are only three types of co-op.
And so what of the co-ops that you've helped incorporate in the last year, 10 years, is there kind of a percentage of those types?
Most recently, I think that we're looking at, I would probably say, many worker co-ops,
yeah.
Small worker co-ops, you know, wonderful groups. But many cases, you know, when I think about like the Shift Delivery Co-op here in town, you know, that's a worker co-op. You know, the Victory Gardens co-op is a worker co-op. So in general, people are looking for ways to employ themselves in a way that gives them a little bit of control over their employment, and so they form worker co-ops. I did just finish a project, my last co-op project that launched in fall of 2014. It was a bus co-op. So really, you know, and that would be a consumer co-op because people are using the buses and paying the co-op for using the buses. Yeah.
And that's a consumer co-op.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is the name of the co-op?
It's the Fraser Valley Transportation Co-op. It's wonderful. Actually, it's a beautiful model because there were a number of things about it. If you bear with me for a couple of minutes, one of them was it came out of the seniors community, right? And it came out of a senior serving agency. That was kind of the host that started the whole thing. When they finally actually launched the co-op, they decided they'd sell it to any kind of social service agency that wanted. They'd sell the service or sell membership, offer membership to any kind of a nonprofit agency that provided rides to its client group. You know, but it was a product of the seniors community. So I really liked that. I also really liked the fact that when we set it up, rather than crafting everything from the ground up, we turned to the community. And so all of the fleet management service is being provided under contract by Modo.
That's pretty cool.
And all of the backroom management stuff is being provided by a business that was set up out of a nonprofit agency, essentially a social enterprise called STAR, that's set up out of Better Environmentally Sound Transportation. So it was perfect. Like BESS, STAR can actually provide the backroom management services more economically than them having to hire somebody. right? And it's a clean contract. It's a beautiful contract. Everybody gained. Everybody's winning. And same thing with Modo. I mean, you know, the services that Modo are providing are way more economical than them having to hire staff to take care of the buses. So I thought that was pretty sweet.
That is.
And
that's awesome.
The whole thing was, the development was funded by Vancity. The launch was financed by Vancity. So it's all credit union money. So the whole thing is just a beautiful little co-op example.
Nice.
Yeah.
And the consumers of this service are the members?
The consumers are actually not, yeah, they're the members, and the members are all societies. There are no individuals involved in this.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Right, yeah. So if you're a society and you provide rides to your client group, then you go join the bus co-op and you don't have to own a bus. This really came out of just that whole thing. I had done a fair amount of work setting up this Star service a few years ago, and I remember the thing that I was struck by was how many nonprofit agencies own a bus and it sits in the driveway 6.5 days of the week, and then half a day, you know, takes a group out for a ride, and I just thought, what a underutilized resource that is. So let's bring it together.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I recently read an article on the BC Co-op Association's newsletter. It's called The Co-op Confidential with Marty Frost. And in it is a pretty epic list of cooperatives that you've worked with in the past. And I was just curious if you could tell us a little bit about the work you've done with some of these. So we're here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, and
yeah.
I know you've done work with us in
yeah.
the past.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff have you done with Co-op Radio?
Well, back in the day, I was on the board. That would be late 70s probably. Mostly now, I have this thing where when the new board comes into play, the first board meeting, I come out and I do sort of a little one-hour orientation to the co-op structure and being a co-op and being a co-op director and what that's all about. And I love doing that. I just love doing that. But you know, there's a number of times when board members have called me and said, you know, this is happening. What can we do about this? You know, it's matters of policy or matters of legalities within the co-op structure and everything like that. And I'll help out where I can. Yeah.
Great. And I know it's been, yeah, a welcome to have someone to talk to.
We all need someone to talk to, Robin.
So there's other ones on here. I'm just going to pick a couple that I know of,
sure.
And I'm curious. Our Equal Village on the island. Village Co-op.
Yeah. Yeah, fascinating group. One of the most polished consensus working groups I've ever worked with. Very good at their consensus process. They had a couple of co-ops. I actually helped them work with a couple of co-ops. They were developing this eco-village, and they wanted to have a co-op own the property that they were living on. They were living on a lovely piece of property, partly ALR land and partly not. So they wanted a co-op to own the land. And so we got that co-op set up. They had very complicated share structures, probably one of the most complicated or comprehensive, if you will, share structures that I've ever seen. But they also set up a little worker co-op that would operate out of the eco-village, and it was basically sustainable construction was going to be their specialty. I don't know how much they've ever done with that co-op, but certainly the eco-village is there, and it's a treat to go visit. It's just such a treat. I mean, they build all kinds of cob buildings, and they've got, you know, stained glass everywhere. They've got a yurt up in the field. They've got animals and chickens and children, kids running around, you know. It's just a lovely place to go visit. Yeah.
That sounds pretty awesome. Peace Energy Cooperative.
Oh, yeah. That was great. That's a very innovative group. This is back in the early 2000s, I think, 2003 or something. There's a place up near Dawson Creek called Bear Mountain, and it supposedly, somebody heard that it was one of the two best places in BC for wind generation because of the clean winds, and so they decided they were going to set up a wind farm and provide power to people in Dawson Creek as well as into the grid, and so they set up the co-op. And again, really, you know, as many do, a very unique structure. Basically, they, like, every member bought a share in the co-op, but also every member committed to paying $20 a month to the co-op. And the co-op built up a supply of cash, and eventually they set out a business plan and a partnership model, and they have their first, I can't remember whether it's two or three generators they have up now, wind generators they have up. They partnered with a group, I think, out of Nanaimo that specialized in wind generation, and I thought that was a great thing for them to do, because, you know, they didn't have enough expertise or resources in-house, so they partnered with them. So now, I mean, this community co-op, where basically they have like 1,500 members in Dawson Creek, and they're not all users of the service by any means, but they're all part owners of this wind farm that's up there. I think they have plans ultimately to be, 8 gigawatts or something like that.
Wow.
Anyway, very ambitious. But the really neat thing that I found out was... after they installed the first... by the way, I don't know if they still have it, but if you go on their website, they had this great clip of a ship from Germany carrying in the first wind generator, the vanes for the first wind generator, coming up through the St. Lawrence Seaway. It was just fabulous. But they got the first, I think, two or three generators up, and then they started on a second project. And the second project was to... take an abandoned swimming pool in a school, I think it was, and actually use the water in the pool for a heat sink to help heat surrounding houses.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, brilliant, just brilliant, you know, and they had the engineering worked out, you know, and it sounded, you know, anyway, just really very inventive and very accomplished. I mean, I was astounded at what they accomplished. Part of it was the openness to just go out and partner with somebody else on the thing and not be held to trying to do it all themselves.
That's really cool.
Yeah, very cool.
I did want to sort of get into talking a bit about the BC and its co-op sector, Marty.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned coming to BC in the late 70s, and then also we talked a little bit earlier about this wave of co-ops around the 70s there. And
yeah,
you described it as the CCEC, community of co-ops. And I was wondering if you could sort of expand on that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I just think, I mean, that was a very exciting time. It must have been a very exciting time. I came here in 78 and got in, I won't say on the tag end of it, because there was a lot still going on. I mean, my co-op, CRS Workers Co-op, was incorporated in 76, and I joined in 78. So it's not like it was had been around for a long time. But I call it CC. I call it the CCEC, Community of Co-ops, because I still look at CCEC, and I kind of think of CCEC's community as like a small town. It's like living in a small town, you know, because you get that same kind of acquaintanceship, because everybody, you keep running into the same people, you know, the people that shop at the East End Storefront Co-op, they, you know, truck around on Commercial Drive and stuff. And many of the co-ops were members and are members of CCEC Credit Union. And I guess the other thing too is that I kind of think that when you get a co-op development, like a kind of a hub of co-op activity, and like was happening in the 70s, because, you know, I mean, that's when a number of collectives were started, you know, East End Storefront Co-op was started around that time, just on and on. I mean, CRS Workers Co-op was started around that time. So a lot of co-ops that got pretty successful. You know, there's always something about that kind of development, and most or many times what it is a repository of community capital, and that's what CCEC is, you know, and I've always found it very interesting that it served that purpose then, it serves that purpose still, because it is a bond, like it's got a bond of association, the credit union does, and that's a community group. Like, you have to be a member of a co-op or a community group to be a member of CCEC. So it's closed bond. That's the term I was looking for, closed bond credit union. So I think I still think of CCEC that way, and and the people at CCEC. Like when I moved to BC, CCEC, the second day I was here in BC from the Maritimes, I joined the East End Storefront Food Co-op and I joined CCEC. Catherine Ruffin was there at the time, and she told me exactly where the best school for our kids, you know. So we took the kids off and looked at the school, and that same day found a house within a couple of blocks of the school that was for rent, and were able to rent the house. You know, it was just kind of a something that was meant to be. but I think that's the thing. You know, I think that our co-ops will develop around a hub, you know, and sometimes, often, the hub is financial. Or it has some sort of link to financing startups and so on.
Okay, so that's interesting. I got to ask you about a few of those terms. So, yeah. What is a closed bond credit union?
Oh,
what
does that mean? A closed bond credit union is one of the credit unions where you have to be something in order to be there. Now, so for example, Vancity, for example, is a closed bond credit union. They are for, I'm not just exactly sure, it's not the city of Vancouver, I think it's Greater Vancouver, is there, you know, that's where they do their business, is in this area. That's why they don't have credit unions, you know, in other places. CCEC, as I say, the bond of CCEC is you have to be a member of a co-op or a community group. You know, lots of them, even the trade credit unions, you know, like the Teamsters have their own credit union, teachers had their own credit union, you know, lots of things like that. And you have to be that in order to be a member of the credit union. That's a closed bond.
Okay. So are there credit unions that aren't?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, open bond credit unions.
that stands for reason.
Yeah.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this idea of this community capital group.
Yeah.
And why this unique place where co-ops can thrive.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The real standing example is the Mondragon system in Spain, you know, because there, the Caja Laboral, which is their credit union, is just a huge part. The Caja Laboral, you know, it's the credit union, the banking system for most, probably, you know, most of the members of most of the co-ops. Most of the co-ops are members. The Caja Laboral was probably part of actually establishing most of the co-ops because they have a very a wonderful development system in Spain in the Mondragon system for developing the new co-ops that come along there, you know. It's just, it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I went to that summit of the co-ops in Quebec and listened to some of the people from Mondragon talking about weathering the financial crisis there.
Yes.
And how the credit unions were very much propping up co-ops that otherwise might have failed financially, just as that support system.
Yeah.
And is that something that you could see happening here as well, or that type of close-knit community? Can that exist in other places, or is it sort of intrinsic in their fabric?
Well, it's the Basque people, you know, it's and so there's a certain amount of that, what you say, it's in the fabric of their culture to do things together. You'd be very apt to find it in Quebec, because they have very much, excuse me, the same kind of thing. They have that same kind of cohesion, social cohesion. Would you find it here in BC? Probably not. We don't have the population density. We don't have the density of small businesses or large businesses, for that matter, and the sort of concentration of capital that it takes to support that kind of thing. But propping up, I mean, they've always had that. Like from the first co-op in the Mondragon system, I believe, was 1956 it was started. And I think in 1990-something was the first time they ever laid off a worker.
Ever. Wow.
Yeah. And they did that because of the close association among all the co-ops, you know, and the layers of cooperativism that they've set up in the Mondragon system. And like I say, the Caja Laboral is right at the center of all of that. And I often thought, you know, can CCEC do that? Could CCEC do that? But like CCEC is still a relatively small credit union, and so it doesn't have the kind of economic clout, anything like what the Caja Laboral has. And you know, and really there's probably not enough capital in the community to get CCEC to that point where they could do that.
Mm-hmm. So you came here from the East Coast
in
the late 70s, and were you doing co-op work prior to that?
Not really, no. I was doing, I guess you'd call it municipal administration. I was working for a planning commission on managing a set of services for five towns in one county. I was on the board of the credit union, the local credit union, though. There was definitely a budding value set there that was coming up. And you know, my reason for coming out to BC was that we had friends out here and they were all talking about this amazing cooperative community out here. And there's co-op housing. So what's that? You know? And so, yeah, it was definitely a big change.
Okay, and so what turned your light bulb on about co-ops? Like, what made you want to become a co-op developer?
Oh, co-op developer? Oh, that was working in my worker co-op, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I worked in my worker co-op for 19 years, and the last 10 years as general manager of the co-op, and we were strongly co-op. We were a political co-op. CRS Workers Co-op.
What did you guys do?
We started and operated Uprising Bread's Bakery, and we started and operated Horizon Distributors, Tunnel Canary Cannery, Peak Bars. We manufactured Peak Bars, or not Peak Bars. I can't remember the name of the bars now. Anyway, by the time I left the co-op, we were 65 members and about 100 full-time equivalent workers.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you say you're political co-op. What does that mean?
Yeah. It means that we did nothing thoughtlessly. You know, some of it kind of borders on the ridiculous now. For example, it took us, I think, 3 years of discussion and debate to buy computers, because there is the argument that it replaced workers, you know, and that's not what we wanted to do. We were, after all, a workers' co-op. There's the whole idea, you know, at the time, there was the whole, a lot of controversy around CRTs and the effect they had on people's work and the effect they had on people's health. So, and the thing was, in my co-op, you had to deal with those things. You know, you couldn't just shove those, oh yeah, but that's not a big thing, and do it. You know, we dealt with those things. The discussion to establish a board of directors, because in the early days we did everything in general meeting. You know, we were the general assembly. Everybody was a member of the board. We had no management structure, no board structure. To create a board of directors, again, took 3 years of discussion and debate among the membership to create a board of directors. And to create a management structure took just as long. So when I say a political co-op, I say that in the most positive of terms, because we really were thoughtful about what we were doing. We didn't take stuff for granted. Nobody took stuff for granted, you know, and often decisions which people would consider fairly routine now, we would have people leave in protest. They'd quit their jobs in protest, you know, and often they'd come back later, but you know, the statement was there, you know, that we don't agree with this strongly enough that we're not going to be part of the co-op. So yeah, we were a political co-op, and you know, to this day, the quality of stuff that our membership did, I look back and I just don't see it anywhere else. You know, we really, like I say, we were thoughtful, we were considered, we had fantastic policy structure. Our general membership owned the policy structure, not the board of directors, you know, and we did a lot of stuff right. Not everything, you know, but we did a lot of stuff right.
I'm a bit fascinated by the thought of 65 members acting like a board, and it actually reminds me again of like thinking of some of the stuff I've heard about the Mondragon co-op, where you've got this overarching organization that has 265 people who are, or 260 co-ops that are participating in running it.
I know.
So what does that look like when you have a worker co-op of that many people?
Well, by the time we were 65 members, we had a fairly well enshrined management structure and board structure. You know, if you looked at our co-op, from the outside, in many ways, it looked like a conventionally managed company, right? But the fact is that the power was all in the workers. You know, like I, as the general manager of the co-op, I reported to a board, and that board was all made up of workers. You know, and yes, they called me to task. I was accountable to them very directly, to the workers in the co-op. And we intentionally set up the structures that way. We wanted to have a management structure because of the inherent efficiencies. And that are there. I mean, you know, people talk about, oh, a dictatorship is the most efficient form of government, right? Well, we worked with those efficiencies, or we tried to establish those efficiencies without us, and still maintain the accountability. And I think that's, and we're relatively successful with that, I think. Yeah.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. I'd love to ask you more about that, but we'll save that for another time.
Another time.
So, at what point did you decide that co-op development was the next course?
Well, one of the things that happened a lot, we always listed ourselves as CRS Workers Co-op in the phone book. So everybody that wanted to know about co-ops, there was no BC Co-op Association, you know, there was nothing like that. And so if they wanted information, they looked up co-op and there was us. Right. So they'd phone us and say, I want to start a co-op, you know, and I'm thinking of this and that and the other thing. And really, you know, my board was fairly clear that I kind of had a mandate to deal with that kind of thing. Right. So part of my job, I think, and partly, you know, it was because I had a bit of a skill set that applied to this kind of stuff. And, you know, and my board was pretty clear that that's OK. You know, you can do a certain amount of that. You got to be here, you know, and so on. But within the limits of what our demands are on you, you can do that kind of thing, and we'll support you in doing that. I went to Mondragon. I mean, I, you know, and trained and did a training thing in Mondragon, you know, and my board supported me in doing that, and my co-op supported me, you know, at least partially in doing that. I, you know, they would send me off to a PSC Workers Co-op in Victoria. It was they ran a food wholesaler as well, and I was over there. I was often over there helping them with their bookkeeping systems, helping them with their job descriptions and stuff like that. And that was, you know, we really saw that as part of our co-op mandate is, look, we have this resource, let's make it available to other co-ops. And we did that. And so I kind of got tagged into that whole idea of co-op development, of, you know, of training, of the needs of people to start co-ops and stuff like that. One of the things I did as part of that was I was one of the founders of the Worker Co-op Federation. And that, again, was my board giving me the mandate to say, yes, you know, go ahead, take the time to set up this meeting back east, and yes, go to the meeting and so on. And that's where we started the Worker Co-op Federation development. And so, again, you know, it was a CRS product. And kind of, again, that exposed me to the Quebec sector, where they had, you know, this networks, they had networks and federations of CDRs, which were the regional development co-ops, you know, and the CDRs had staff, for heaven's sake, that were co-op developers. It's just, and so I looked at that and said, well, gosh sakes, you know. There'd also been a number of initiatives like that in BC by that time. You know, there was but they were all done when there was grant money available. You know, you set up a little office, and there was one that was set up in New Westminster. Melanie actually worked for that, with that group, and Shane Simpson, who's now in the NDP in Victoria. And so that was one of them. But they both mostly they just lasted as long as the grant money was there, because they weren't really market-oriented. What they were was they were there as a service because their costs were paid for. Right, I wanted to see if we could do something on a market basis.
So how did that the Worker Co-op Federation, as it was coming together?
Yeah.
How did you find all the worker co-ops to federate? Were you all already talking to each other?
Well, partly, yeah. Because. Like during the part of the work in setting up for this, like getting ready for this, like we worked for a year. There were three of us: Jack Quarter, who's a co-op guy in Ottawa; Bob Allen, who was with the Big Carrot at the time, which is a big co-op food store in Toronto, and me, right? And we set about to set up this meeting, right? And part of that was going into the Canadian Co-op Association office and say, tell us every worker co-op that exists in Canada. And they couldn't, didn't, of course, because most of them didn't classify themselves as worker co-ops, but they could give us every worker every co-op in Canada. So we took that and kind of started there, and anyone that had worker co-op in its name or anyone that looked like it might be a worker co-op and stuff like that, we all sort of spread those out and went looking for them. We knew of some. There were some that people knew instantly. There was a big fishery worker co-op in Newfoundland that everybody said, you know, well, you got to go talk to them. And, you know, we ran into just that whole thing. We ran into people like Peter Huff in Nova Scotia, you know. He had started a worker co-op development co-op. A worker co-op that was doing co-op development. And that had been going on in Nova Scotia, and I knew nothing about that, you know. And that was exactly what I wanted to do. So yeah, it was just a case of, you know, nose to the ground or ear to the ground, nose to the grindstone, yeah. Whatever it is. And just using the resources that were there to develop other resources.
And so has this, it's the CWCF, the Canadian Worker Co-op Federation. It's very, you hear about it all the time in the co-op sector in Canada.
Yes.
Is it pretty self-sufficient then? Or does it have outside help from all the, like, is it just supported by the worker co-ops, or is there other outside help at this point? Or?
A little bit of both of them, but it's not so much outside help. It's it's supported by the worker co-ops. It has a great membership, but it also has a loan fund, you know, because I have to say the worker co-op federation has always kind of, what's that expression? Fights above its weight or something like that.
Punches above its weight,
yeah. And really, you know, we were doing things and we were pushing things for a long time. We alienated the, you know, in some cases alienated the greater co-op sector, because we were just these little upstarts, you know, and what are we doing going off and applying to HRSDC for $1.5 million to set up a loan fund for starting up worker co-ops? What are you trying to do? What we're trying to do was set up a loan fund to start worker co-ops, and we did it. And you know, and a number of stuff. So that helps us. We also found out that there's this whole thing about putting your shares in a self-administered RRSP, your co-op shares. Worker co-ops can do that. It's much more difficult now, but then it wasn't. So we set up as a substitute for, excuse me, we set up in the Federation the capacity to actually administer self-administered RRSPs. We did the work that a trust company normally would, or a credit union or something like that, but we didn't do the actual trust work. We did the clerical work and kept track of that stuff. And we had a portfolio of, you know, probably $8-9 million in self-administered RRSPs, and we were getting paid for doing that every year. So we got, you know, Tenacity Works is there. It's not really making us money, really.
Yeah.
But the RRSP program makes us money. So and then we were invited to become a member owner of Cooperators Insurance Group. So the Worker Co-op Federation is now one of the member owners of Cooperators Group, and they have a fantastic member loyalty program, where you know, that results in distribution of surplus to its member owners.
Wow, that's really neat.
Yeah. So things like that, you know, again. Very, very inventive little group, and dedicated and hardworking.
We are coming to the end here, and there's so much more I would like to ask you. So I'd love to have you back soon. My last question on my list of questions was, what does Marty Frost's ideal society look like? But I don't know if we have enough time to go into that.
No, we don't. I can guarantee it. And Marty Frost's ideal society?
Well, I've heard you say before, you know, I've heard you say before, you know, my ideal society is not a society only of co-ops.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You mean economic society?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to sort of follow up with you and really... Yeah. Dive into that a bit. I just, unfortunately, we have run out of time.
So understand.
We'll have to save that for another conversation. And I just really appreciate you coming down here this evening and sharing with us your knowledge about co-op development and your experiences here in BC. It's just fascinating, and I really, it's been a pleasure working with you on the boards that we've worked with together, and thanks. It's a
pleasure for me too, Robin.
We've been talking with Marty Frost, co-op developer at DevCo. Oh, I wanted to know if you wanted me to plug any URLs or email addresses or anything like that for people who might want to get in touch.
With me?
Yeah.
Devco.coop, www.devco.coop, right. And
Marty at devco.coop. And we'll be back next week here on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Next week, we'll be actually visiting with Ross Gentleman, the executive director of CCEC Credit Union, which we're really excited to have on the show as well. If you have any questions, you can email or tweet us. Our email is ideas@eachforall.coop. And our Twitter is @EachForAll. Website is EachForAll.coop. And thanks for joining us tonight on Vancouver Cooperative Radio. This, of course, is your radio station. And if you want to become a member, you can check us out online at coopradio.org. This is 100.5 FM in Vancouver, CFRO. Thanks for listening. Have a cooperative evening. We're going to leave you with Where the Wild Things Are. This is Patrick Watson. Monsters that are chasing me all.